I'm going to jump. It's just the only thing.
You're going to jump from Stratos? You're going to die.
I'm okay with this. I have made my peace with the fact that we are at the dregs of this show.
Yeah. These
are the last four episodes they released. It's going to be awful, isn't it?
The third season at this point feels like one of the worst things that I have ever done in my life.
I feel dirty.
It's a slog. These two episodes, the Cloud Minders,
which I cannot remember that name,
and the Savage Curtain,
which I cannot remember that name,
are just they're indescribably terrible.
You know, I have a. Well, let's talk about this.
The Cloud Minders is strange because it gets better as it goes along. I think the episode legitimately does get stronger as it continues on. And then it sort of plateaus at a average level of quality. And then the last 10 minutes happen and it just precipitously drops. Like, the person who jumped off the city earlier.
Because he realized that if he stayed in that episode, he would have more lines, and he just, you know, did not want to have that. how many times this feels like a first draft? I mean, this is an interesting premise. It's this city where this is a utopia. Now this is the plot of Bioshock Infinite, but you have the city that's this utopia.
And, well, isn't Bioshock Infinite the plot of the Cloud Minders?
Well, you know, depending on whether or not time travel is involved.
It's not.
Okay.
I'll answer that question for you right now.
Oh, okay. Good. Or is it? Actually, I have a theory based on the next episode, but we're going to get into that later. You have the city, which is this intellectual, they're based on the arts, they're based on, you know, music and all of that, and, you know, everything.
It's like Athens, basically.
Yeah, it's a paradise. It's a utopia.
Fine. Great.
We've seen a few of these before. That's awesome.
I do have a question for you, though.
I'm ready.
Why is paradise always so fucking boring?
Well, because all the rock musicians are in hell.
So I want to go to hell, then?
I would like you to go to hell. Oh! I would not like you to go to hell, Eric, although I am a rock musician, so...
But I think it's a legitimate question, though, because whenever we see a paradise in the original series, it always seems incredibly boring and stulted and just kind of dead.
It's a fairly traditional depiction of heaven, and, I mean, that is a legitimate critique. Perfection is that it's static, it is unchanging, it is, and... The series doesn't seem to have a problem with that necessarily, although there has never been a stable paradise in this episode. In the series, every time there has been a paradise, it has been built on the backs of something.
Yeah, and this is no exception.
I would say, and in this, it's a slave labor type of scenario, essentially.
Right.
And
you say it's the plot of Bioshock Infinite. It's really
it's a tradition.
It's really the plot of Metropolis.
It's the plot of anything when you have a, you know, it's the plot of history, let's face it.
Yeah.
You know? So
I mean, this is taken to an almost absurd literal degree, where you have people actually, you know, literally toiling on the surface, and you have people that are floating above in the clouds. And you know, it's a Star Trek science fiction show, so they can get away with that in some respects.
And again, I'm fine with that.
It seems kind of precipitous to me, though. Like, why you would want to build a city that was dependent on anti-grav technology that perhaps would fail at some point, and your city would go crashing to the earth, and everyone would die, and the city would destroy itself. I mean, that just seems...
Well, children, that's what we call hubris. I was going to say, there are a lot of myths about that.
If the Cloud Minders had ended with that happening, I think I would have liked the episode a lot more than I did.
I was going to say, I'm surprised that that didn't happen, that the... And what do they call them? Not the dissenters, but the...
The disruptors.
Disruptors. If they had been... revealed to have been doing something like that to, you know, be sabotaging the things which stop the anti-grav field. And then it turns out that by doing so, they're going to destroy their own people. Like, that would have been a... But anyway. there are so many just speeches that are made in this episode. We have a lot in the next one, but there are a lot where they are having philosophical debates over what the status of this underclass.
And I actually liked that.
Well, I do and I don't, because on the one hand, this the daughter of the, basically she's the princess character. That is what her life would be. She would be just having philosophical debates for most of the day. Most of, you know, that's what the life of the mind is. So, I mean, it does completely make sense for her to be framing this in that sense. That's how she speaks. At the same time...
And she's also attracted to Spock, which I think makes sense.
Oh, completely. You know, I actually like at one point the father says, you know, oh, well, you know, Captain Kirk will be back, you know, and... She's almost laughing. She's like, I'm not thinking about Kirk. I'm thinking about Spock. Like, you know, but, you know, the normal is the handsome starship captain. That's not who she wants.
I mean, I think there's an implication in the episode that the female leader of the Disruptors is attracted to Kirk, which.
Yes.
Maybe the episode is a little bit smarter than we're giving it credit for, although not much smarter, because you do have a nice little dichotomy there between the woman who is a laborer, who is intense and physical and sweaty, going for Kirk, who was exactly that type of captain and officer.
Both of them are very decisive, very, you know...
Right.
Man and a woman of action. Yeah, they...
And then you have the very sort of, like, laid-back, intellectual, logical...
Detached
woman going for Spock.
Appreciation for the arts and the sciences. You know, yeah, the two sets are actually well-matched. That is actually a better... That's an interesting.
It doesn't go anywhere, but
yeah, but
like so much of this episode doesn't go anywhere.
To be fair, I didn't really need much more than that. Like, it's implied that, you know, they do their interest is more implied in both cases. At one point, I think he like grabs the leader of the troglodytes like just face just affectionately, like, and you know that's about the only super romantic. Physical affection they show for each other, but
I think that can
happen off screen. I'm okay with that.
I do think it's strange though that Spock goes out of his way to answer her questions about his mating habits. It seems very, very weird.
At the same time, he does say she basically says, "Oh, well, there's nothing to disrupt that." So he says, "Oh, you know." I don't remember the exact line, but he says, you know, I do find you disruptive or something like that, like as one of those weird Spock compliments. But
yeah, but if you remember, you remember from all the way back in Amok Time, he was going out of his way to not tell anyone what was going on. He was like really ashamed. He was like, this is a private thing that only Vulcans should know about.
Yeah. And now at this point, it's a year and a half later and it's become common knowledge in the galaxy.
So you're telling me that just because Spock had his Ponfar, everyone in the galaxy now knows about it? It doesn't fit his character, is what I'm saying.
Well, maybe he has started a blog about it now.
No, they don't do that in the 23rd century.
Well, oh, you're right. What do you think the captain's logs?
No,
are?
But I'm serious though. Take me seriously here. Like,
that is a point. I can agree. Find this woman attractive. While I agree he would find her compelling. While I agree that he could even fall for her. Would he this quickly talk about this in those terms? I'm not sure.
No, I don't think he would. And I think it highlights and goes back to a problem that we've seen throughout the third season of the show, where they're not interested really in developing the characters more fully or logically or consistently. Mm. And they're just sort of interested in telling us mildly entertaining stories about stock drama characters.
I didn't say it was a good twist. I mean, maybe he's just... Maybe after the Romulan commander, you know, maybe she kind of unlocked...
I mean, you would think that he would talk about it with the Romulan commander woman more than he would with anybody else.
Because he and she least, had more...
At least they have a biological consistency there.
It could even be a... It actually would be very natural for the Romulan and the Vulcan to discuss Ponfar because... I mean, given that they have a common ancestry, I wonder if the Romulans have a similar issue in
right,
their culture.
Right.
Either way, the two of them would be interested in that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's something that they would. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. I mean, am I trying to make this episode sound better than it is? Maybe.
Well, I think we have to talk about the troglites and we have to talk about the disruptors because
we have to.
My problem with this episode is that it starts out very poorly, and you know they beam down to this planet and they get lassoed by the disruptors, and then
that was the moment
God
right?
comes down yeah. and saves them and tells them to go away. And then you know it slowly gets a little better where they start revealing some more of the flavor of the plot and the planet they're on. And
for a while, I like it because it's a no bad guys situation. Because it's a while what the city is doing is something we would consider morally wrong, it's something that they have not questioned and they have not realized is a moral wrong, and therefore they're the antagonists due to error rather than malice in
right.
some ways. And then to you know, and I appreciate that where it is two philosophical oppositions and they eventually figure out a way of making, you know, the two of them compromise. And yet he just gets randomly, you know, Kirk is sitting and explaining everything to him and he's all, well, no, that's stupid, which, I mean, that is how racist people think.
Well, okay, you said the word right there, racist. I think, you know, we talked about Let That Be Your Last Battlefield a couple episodes ago.
Yeah.
And you know, while that episode was very much about racism, and I argued it was very much about specifically American racism, you know, of the 1960s and the way that we were going with civil rights and race riots and,
yeah.
and things of that nature. I think this episode is oddly not specifically about slavery so much, or not specifically about American slavery, but it is about the concept of slavery, and it's about, you know, what the people in power, you know, the logical contortions that they go through to justify the enslavement of, you know, other people.
Yeah. And I say race and that's largely because, you know, race and oppression and underclass are generally, at least in America, tied together.
But at the same time, you know, while the leader of the disruptors, who is this sort of like rebel band of troglites, is I think white. She's the same race as
they are explicitly said to be
the Stratodians or whatever the hell they are.
It's specific. Yeah, the only differences that they have in which are largely just of personality. I feel that there are no physical differences. I think they specifically mentioned.
Yeah, they
that.
Said. Yeah, they basically said that they are the same species and that you know the other troglites sort of look a little more swarthy and sort of look a little more dark skinned, but it's not anything that really screams out, you know, race to me.
Yeah.
But they do explicitly set it up.
They have very different lifestyles that alone could account for some differences.
Well, I mean, if you think about it in terms of the troglites are the ones who were doing all of the hard physical
yeah,
labor,
right.
and the Stratosians are up in their cloud city. Sitting around and reading books and jerking
down
off
below,
all the time.
They are going to get a lot. They are going to generally be more muscular. That's just going to happen naturally.
Yeah.
But
they're
essentially inhaling, you know, gaseous PCP all day. That's the only reason there's a difference between them.
Yeah, but and that's, you know, we'll get to that plot point. But my problem with this is that they do set it up as sort of this, you know, a philosophical difference, and they do set it out to have an episode that's about something and about, you know, starting to convince these people that the troglites are not inferior and that they should be treated with respect and they should be treated with dignity and perhaps they should be allowed to live in Stratos. And it turns it into something which I find the end of the episode to be basically Star Trek throwing up its hands and going, okay, we don't want to do this anymore. We started on a different path and now we're going in a different direction. We don't actually want to get to the logical conclusion of the questions that we raised. And we're just going to allow for a facile answer to the problem. Oh, well, the troglites are now... They have their little masks on. They're not going to be inhaling the gas that makes them stupid. So they'll be happy to be slaves. I mean, that's basically the end of the episode. And
if it ended with the equivalent of, well, I mean, to say that there cannot be a working class is that's impossible.
But you have to treat them with.
Well, but that's the thing. to get into, to say, okay, so we need a working class. What is a way of treating the working class in a manner that, you know, gives them a fair wage and does give them good living conditions? And, you know, that kind of thing. Basically, how do you turn slavery into employment?
It's not even about the working class and the class system necessarily and all these sort of like air quote things that we're saying. You know, what the real issue here is that, yes, you always are going to have people in any society that have more money and that own companies and own land and things like that and employ people. And what you really need to do, I think, is not focus on class so much and focus more on making sure that there are no systemic inequalities throughout the economic system and even the social justice system.
In other words,
don't stack the deck against the people who are mining your coal for
you. Someone needs to mine the coal. Someone needs to sell the coal. They're very different skill sets, and you know, no one is better than the other.
Right.
You may need more workers to do the coal just because of the scope of the work, but again, that doesn't make one better than the other. And they both need to sleep in good beds at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't really get a sense that we're supposed to think that the people of Stratos are exploiting these people, and they are exploiting those people. But I don't really get a sense that at the end of the episode they've learned that lesson at all.
Yeah, the princess basically says, like, oh, you know, she has that interesting line that I don't like to call them masks or filters. You know, I think we should call them protectors. And, oh, white man's burden is suddenly on the table. Also, the leader of the troglites says something like, you know, oh, we've got many demands. You know, from her point of view, she's basically, look, things are changing. You know, no matter what, things are going to be good and better for us. We're going to get something into where, you know, we're going to work with you and we are going to tell you what policies need to change. That's the postscript of this episode. The fact that she's still framing it as demands, that the fact that the leader isn't saying, like, all right, you know, now we're going to work out and we're going to, you know, work it and we're going to make a society that we can all live in together. You know, if both of them had agreed to work together for that, that would have been the episode that Star Trek would have earned.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've talked before about episodes of Star Trek where at the end these broad societal changes happen too quickly. I think in this episode, you know, I would not have been averse to seeing that just because it would have at least felt like Star Trek. This episode feels like a morality play taking place in Mississippi in 1963, where black people are suddenly happy to be separate but equal, and the white people go on to be happy and fat and wonderful.
It could have ended with they have a, you know, video conference with, you know, with the two of them. Oh, you know, in the past year, you know, we've made all these changes. You know, now people live. You know, now Stratos is both troglites and Stratons, you know, and on the surface, you know, there's different people working there too. And, you know, everything, you know, a lot of really interesting things, you know, you need to really see Stratos now. And that's how they could have done that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That they could, you know, they could have done it in dialogue. They should have had the time skip where, again, they learn to work together.
Or even not even have a time skip where they learn to work together, but just end the episode on a more optimistic note where, you know, Kirk says, well, now that we know that the troglites are not stupid genetically and they are being injured on the job and they need workman's comp, in effect, that the people of Stratos or the leader of Stratos would have recognized that and would have said, yes, okay, well, you know, now we are going to protect the troglites. You know, if they want to continue working there, they can continue working there. That's the life they've known. They're comfortable. If the people of Stratos want to work in the mines, go ahead and work in the mines. Not that they're going to. Wow. And obviously, this is going to be a disruptive event, but that even would have been a better ending than the one we got.
Yeah, it's one where their integration of this society would, as you know, we have seen in Hell in America, would come at it would take a long time and it would be a difficult struggle, but it's something that this planet needs to go through, and I wish that the episode had been a little less realistic about that.
Yes, because if you can say one thing about the original series, I think realistic is not one of the things that you would say about it. And so
I can accept that there is a spaceship going through space faster than light. I can accept that the happy ending that I want, the morally correct ending, happens a little more quickly and a little more easily than it really would have, because to feel good about that message, yeah. You know, that
or even like I said, just a recognition. Yeah, that's wrong.
They need to give it. It didn't have as much of hope as I thought. It's still that this is happening through force. Again, given the year that this was happening, of course, integration was happening grudgingly and with a lot of force.
Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe it didn't want to make that point. You know, maybe it did want to just reflect that, look, this isn't happening easy for us either. This kind of sucks. It sucks that this happened, and it sucks that we're not going to be able to resolve this easily. There's nothing. We got to muddle through the best we can, and we should have changed it years ago, but this just sucks.
And I think the other interesting thing and the other problematic thing about that aspect of the episode is that the planet, I think, is supposed to be a member of the Federation, and
no, they weren't, actually.
Okay.
The planet that they...
Because I thought that was really strange, because I didn't really get a sense of why they didn't just kick them out then.
Well, what had happened with because Spock summarizes the episode a few times for us in case we weren't paying attention.
That was very strange.
That was very filler.
I was going to say that was just them realizing that the episode was 3 minutes short.
Yeah, exactly. So there's this other planet off to the side which has some kind of there's essentially a blight on all the plants. Plants are slowly dying, and if all plant life dies, eventually the entire planet is going to die. Pretty similar, pretty standard. This planet is the closest planet that produces this chemical that can...
Okay, you're wrong.
Really?
Yes, I just looked it up on Memory Alpha.
Okay.
The planet where the Xenite was and the Troglites and all that stuff is called Ardana, and they're a Federation member.
I thought that that totally wasn't, because...
No.
There is one point when Kirk is talking to the leader, and he says, you know, they're a Federation planet, meaning the planet that's blighted, you know, and... You know, the Federation has to protect its own, like, at the, you know, when he's not sure if he's being tricked or blocked or what, you know, Kirk is kind of putting the muscle of the Federation behind him and saying, look, I've got the Federation on my side. A Federation planet is about to die. If you're blocking me, you have the you're going to have to answer the Federation. And, you know, he immediately, what is his name? The King, basically,
right.
Says, you know, and he takes that very seriously immediately. He says, no, you know, I'm going to find this for you.
No, I think you're correct. But
yeah,
I think you're correct, because Ardana is also a member of the Federation.
Guess it doesn't matter whether you're in or out. You can still be scared of the Federation. Maybe you'd be even more scared if you were a Federation member.
Well, I wouldn't use the word scared, because the Federation is not an organization that uses Starfleet to go around and scare planets. That was even explicitly said.
Not scared in
sense in Mirror
of,
Mirror.
And not scared in the sense of, you know, they're going to be threatening, but I'm sure there's a very big law that blocking, if the King is indeed blocking or tricking them, I'm sure he's violating a major law, and he is going to face some serious jail time for that. He could just be simply not wanting or the diplomatic repercussions of that. Like, there are enough things that will happen if he is blocking a Federation trade that he does not want to happen to his planet.
I just think it's strange because, you know, Ardana is a Federation member, and so even the fact that they are telling them to leave, they're not supposed to interfere with planetary government and all these sort of things, is very strange. Because they're a Federation member. And so I think, you know,
I would think they would have been scouted.
I don't want to go too far down the road of talking about it on a in-universe level, but I think on a plot level and on a storytelling level, it's problematic because...
Yeah.
Being a Federation member doesn't seem to really mean anything. And so the fact that we're so confused about whether or not the planet where the action takes place is even a Federation member or not, is problematic, and it's problematic for the audience as well, because they don't really understand the ground rules of what's going on in this episode.
I thought it was one of those a planet that anytime the Federation has scouted a planet has met a planet and wants to join them, it seems like there is a process involved. It seems like they would have to visit and tour the planet. They'd have to meet with the leadership. They would, you know, need to. I feel like knowing the existence of the oppression on this planet, somebody would have found that out already if they had applied to be in the Federation. So, I mean, again, the sense I got that this was a neutral planet that, you know,
it
doesn't matter really whether it was or not. But you're right that the fact that what does being in the Federation mean? It's a meaningless club at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know. It's not a great episode. So what would you give this one, Richard?
I would give this 3 tribbles.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's like a 2 or 3 for me.
I just...
It's a 3 tribble going down to a 2 tribble because the tribble jumped off Stratos.
How about that? I reproduced on the way down. So, like, there was just... like, it just landed in a gigantic pile of tribbles, so it was okay.
Yeah.
Aww.
All right, let's shake that one off.
Yes, we've got so much better to deal with. Eric, we are about to go further down the spiral.
The Savage Curtain.
You know, one of the things that I have noticed this week in both episodes was we had some masterful choreography. Now, I know that the first major fight scene of this, so I'm thinking of some of the really bad fight scenes we've had, like the Pon Farr fight scene. I mean, anytime Kirk's fought a double, it's been terrible. But this is really some masterful.
Wait, what are you? Wait. You're saying that the Pon Farr fight was bad?
I mean, this must be good if it's certainly very different from what we're seeing now.
Oh yeah, because what we're seeing now is fucking terrible.
I kind of had my eyes closed for most of it. I don't know what happened during any of it.
I'm going to be very honest. My mind was wandering during the Savage Curtain so much.
Okay, so...
Because it was... I don't even know what to say. It's...
So, I mean, I know, and I've talked about during, like, the Indian episode and during the... You know, the Wild West one. It seems like this is a script written by, you know, a teenager who had a history assignment and loved Star Trek way too much. Like,
well, it was written by Gene Roddenberry, so you're not too far off.
Really?
Uh huh.
Oh man! All right. I love this episode so much more now because that makes the shittiness just a deeper level.
I mean, it makes sense.
No, you're completely right when you know.
Roddenberry was very interested in interjecting American historical figures and American history into the show. He was very interested in being terrible. And
I was going to say, I can't fault him on wanting to put American history into the show because number one, given the political stance of the time, given that the space program was very heavily identified with, you know, American nationalism, I get that. At the same time, you don't do that by floating in Abraham Lincoln, floating in the Lincoln Memorial in the vastness of space.
Like, I mean, for the sheer audacity of it.
When I saw that, I cracked the hell up, and I'm like, all right, this is going to be a great episode. But
you have to respect a show that is that willing to be so completely ridiculously outside the bounds of any logic or sense that you just have to go with it and you have to sit back and clap a little bit inside.
Do you think that they thought he was serious when he put the when he handed in the episode? Like,
you
have to, like, because if you get something, like, you have to think, if someone at work sends you a ridiculous email, you think, like, okay, they have to be playing a prank. Like, Space Lincoln, he had to be playing a prank, but he was serious.
I don't know exactly what the background for this episode was, because, you know, as I've said before, Roddenberry was not involved in the third season at all and had left, basically, and was never in his office or on set. and was just collecting a paycheck. Yeah. Now, I don't know if this is something that he had written before and they had just looked at it and said, okay, well, you know what? We've got to do 3 more episodes this season, so let's just make this pile of crap. Because
I would say maybe this was, of the dozen scripts that they had floating around, this was one of the best. I mean, I hate to say it, but possible. Maybe they even just felt, well, we are never again going to have the opportunity to film Space Lincoln, so we're just going to do this episode so we can film Space Lincoln. Like, they may have just even figured for that reason.
I think that you might be overstating how interested anybody was in the show at this point.
So maybe that was just the short, they just picked the first one on the pile.
Like, I, you know, my feeling about this episode and why it was made is that it was cheap. Like, that's basically it. Okay. I mean, there are 2 sets. There's a handful of guest actors, only a couple of which actually speak.
Probably some costumes were left over from other shows.
Yeah, they could take costumes from other episodes and other shows.
I'm sure they had a Lincoln costume somewhere in the studio.
Doesn't take very long for a page to make some spears out of sticks that they picked up in the park across the street. So for all of these reasons,
what about the rock creature?
I can't see that costing that much to put together. I mean, that was probably the most expensive part of the episode, yeah. But it doesn't.
I mean, it's mostly rubber and paper mache.
It doesn't look great, and it looks even worse in HD.
I mean, it looked hilarious. I love the little click click lobster claws.
Yeah, so I you know, I'm sure that was just a bunch of crap they had lying around and could put together. I mean,
really, they just had to just swap a couple pages out of the script of Arena. I mean.
Yeah, and that's the weird thing is that, like, I was thinking about Arena as I was watching this episode because it was very similar but in a much worse way.
Same basic plot except and, having less of a point.
Well, it's an episode that we've seen a lot before in the third season, which is it wears its influences on its sleeve. It's way too on the nose. I mean, they actually go out of their way to say that this is an episode about the fight between good and evil. It's so on the nose.
They're starting to get a little savvy about it, at least, because when, you know, the rock monster is like, well, you need to fight, you know, Kirk is like, I've had this trick before, I'm not gonna fight. Like, and you see, like, he just seems like the kid who, like, knows the answer to the trick question and, like, that's gonna work. And later they say, you know, well, maybe this is, you know, checking our commitment to peace. Like, you know, they openly discuss that this is probably a trap and they have to get the third option now.
And that is the weird part, because we have, I think there's one character in the episode that is at least somewhat interesting. And I will say that, you know, having Abraham Lincoln in the episode is whatever, but at least the actor who's playing him is decent and kind of charming and lends at least
some
interest.
I liked the actor as he was the best Space Lincoln there could have been.
Absolutely.
You want Lincoln to be like a cool guy. You just want you want him to be a badass president who can still wrestle aliens. And he is.
Yeah, it was fine.
Yeah.
It was fine. The other thing I like is I do like Serac, and I do like getting a little bit more detail about Vulcan history. Yeah. That was at least somewhat interesting and in line with what we have seen and heard about Vulcan before.
Genghis Khan as being a character is interesting because the show finds Genghis Khan very important, at least thematically. I mean,
right.
We also have right next to him is somebody who was instrumental in the eugenics wars.
Right.
I thought that was interesting. And then you have 2 other mythical, you know, monster people. At least it wasn't Jack the Ripper. It was very good to have a sci-fi show not do Jack the Ripper when it could have.
Yeah, you had Kalas, who was supposed to be the Klingon who created their society. And you had, I don't know, some witch lady and who wasn't even really, I don't even think she ever said anything in the episode. It was basically only there to look evil.
Yeah, I would say they had a really cool costume and they decided to use this one instead.
But you know, what I wonder about is a show and an episode. And I think that honestly, you can see Gene Roddenberry's fingerprints on the episode, not only because it does deal with American history and puts an American president, you know, directly in the episode as a character. But I also think because it does show at least a little bit of Star Trek knowledge and Star Trek love, you know, Spock calls Kirk Jim at one point on the bridge. And as well, you know, Gene Roddenberry put this character of Serac in there because he did have some knowledge of Vulcan, and we had not really seen any or heard anything about Vulcan in the third season so far. And
yeah, and he's supposed to be one of their folk heroes, and that's interesting that they had that.
Right. But at the same time, I have to wonder, you know, the episode undercuts itself by having Serac in it because Kirk says, oh, well, you know, we're just going to be, as you said, we're just going to be peaceful. We're not going to fight. This is the trick. And the Excalibur or whatever the hell they are said, no, you have to. Like, we're actually doing this. So that's out of the question. And then 20 minutes later, Serac is like, yeah, I'm going to try to be peaceful. So
yeah, and they
you have the father of Vulcan logic who ostensibly was awake and there when Kirk talked to the Excalibur an hour ago and heard that his plan that he now brings up was not an option. I don't know how they missed that.
Even further, you have the eugenics guy. Immediately after the Excalibur leaves, he comes up to Kirk and he says, like, look, I, you know, basically we're evil, but we're not stupid. Like, we there, you know, yeah, I may be evil, but you know, there's no reason for me to fight you. And frankly, 8-1, we may have a shot, you know, if we can do that. And, you know, Kirk immediately says, like, look, this is your thing. Like, I'm not an idiot. You know, you trick people during negotiations. In fact, it is a trick, you know.
Yeah.
And why, you know, that they've shown, and what is the Vulcan guy's name?
Serac.
I cannot remember names. They've shown Sepikul that he, you know, Sepikul's seen that they don't actually want to negotiate. Peace won't work. Why is he going to try 20 minutes later? What's going to change?
Right, exactly.
That too. Like, he's had so many reasons to see not. They just need to get rid of him.
Yeah, for both of those and reasons, then it makes no sense.
I didn't really... Yeah. Then Lincoln died, and then the Klingon was mimicking voices. Did that really happen?
Yes,
okay,
it did.
Okay, that did really happen. All right, good. Lincoln dies at one point, yeah, and Kirk had to say how he got to see Lincoln get shot again, and I did not find that line as seriously as I ought to have, perhaps.
I can understand why you would not.
I'm just gonna say that, just throw that out there, like.
I can't see a reason why this exists. Can you?
Well, I mean, for the charming Negress line alone, I think this episode is worth it just because
there's a couple good lines.
I mean, that entire exchange was just, I had to pinch myself that I was not, you know, asleep at that point and making up really weird shit, because again, that scene happened too, right?
Like, uh-huh. Yeah, no, it did.
Oh, you know,
it did happen
in our time, you know, words are just words, you know.
I guess it's good that Uhura had something to do in the episode.
According to the Wikipedia, this is the last time we see her.
Okay, sure.
Great way to send off.
I have never seen the last episode of the show.
Oh, that'll be sweet. Yeah. Did you notice Kirk's voice cracking?
No,
his voice cracks at one point. They don't bother to refilm that scene, obviously, because I don't think anyone gave a shit.
I did notice in the Cloudminders, to go back to the Cloudminders for a minute, that you know, talking about how the show has been getting more and more, yeah, incompetently put together. Right after the opening credits and they come out of the cold open, the camera is on Kirk and Spock as they're lassoed, and you can hear Kirk's voice, but his mouth isn't moving. Yeah. So that was great.
I've just known, yeah, like, there's a lot of tiny flubs or little things like that that just, if they had had more of a budget, they would have reshot that scene, but they just, you can tell they did not have the time or the money to do that.
I don't think that they care at,
yeah,
this,
that's
point.
It, like, you know, it doesn't matter.
They knew that they were going to be getting canceled, I think, at this point. I mean, they didn't know, but it was fairly obvious that any, you know, anybody could see the writing on the wall about what exactly was happening to the show. And you know, I think the Savage Curtain is a great example of the show just dying
and just, no, of the show killing itself, frankly. Like, I
Well,
there is a thing where they're just like, you know something? We are phoning it in. We don't even give a shit. Here's Space Lincoln. That's the mark of a people who just want. I feel like they want it. Like they're just. It's destroying its own legacy through this.
I'm not really sure that the there's a couple,
not even as deliberate as that, of course.
Well, there's a couple things there. Number one, you know, the show had no legacy at this point, and so. That was not a consideration. I mean, I don't think anybody ever thought that the Star Trek name would be something that people remembered 45 years later. Mm-hmm. I think they thought they were making a show that was being canceled, and that was the end of it. They could not see what was happening, you know, in 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 10 and 20 and 30 years in the future.
Well, of course.
The other thing I think is that, you know, I don't think that you can really fault the show for... You know, and I will defend it a little bit because I don't think you can fault the people working behind the scenes for not doing the best that they could do. I don't want to ascribe motivations to them that we're not aware of, because certainly I think you can make the case that certain actors on the show were probably phoning it in. You know, perhaps everybody on the show was not working as hard as they could have. Certainly Gene Roddenberry wasn't.
Yeah, I mean...
But at the same time... You know, NBC had and the studio had starved the show for money, and they were still being asked to produce 24 episodes of television, and they had to do it. You know, it was a contract that they could not get out of. And so, you know, they were being asked to do something that was, I think, almost impossible to do. And The Savage Curtain is a perfect example of what happens when you try and make science fiction television on the cheap by people who are not really interested in it.
Okay. Well, it's not a good thing when that happens.
That was a fantastic follow-up.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're here.
I am happy to be here. How are you doing today?
I don't think there's anything else to really say about it. It's an awful episode, and...
I really thought it could... Again, when I saw... The Lincoln Memorial in space, I thought, oh, good. This could be at least a stupid camp episode, like a Spock's brain level. This is terrible, but it's hilarious. And it wasn't even that entertaining. That's I guess it. It didn't even camp out.
No, it didn't. It's if I never see this again, it will be too soon.
Well, I hope you never do. I want to give it 4 triples.
I'll give it 1.7.
I understand why.
No, I will give it 480 triples. yeah, it's not great. Well, we're done with that.
I'm glad.
And next week, we have reached the end of the original series.
Our 5-year mission is over.
Can you believe it?
I actually can, because I knew it would be a finite amount of time.
We will be covering the final 2 episodes in the original series, All Our Yesterdays, and Turnabout Intruder.
Oh, that's like with the Phoenix Wright case, right? And like you have to, you know, solve the objection and all of that? That's what happens?
No.
Oh.
So join us then.
For our last episode of Trek About the Original Series.
There may be champagne involved.
I don't like champagne.
I don't either.
Can we get like some Scotch whiskey?
There may be Scotch whiskey involved in honor of Scotty.
Or Scotch tape.
We'll see you then.